This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing, featuring 100% natural fiber clothing for women and men. Real clothing for real people. Proud to sponsor the important voice of KABU, Gazelle is located at Northeast 41st and Fremont and can be reached at 503-288-3422.
Be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KABU News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KABU's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KABU News.
KABU's Eduardo Delanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KABU News.
I'm Michael Newman, KABU News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KABU News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, a corporate speculator has already triggered an Oregon state law against utility takeovers. The Supreme Court won't intervene in the case of two Chinese Muslims locked up by mistake at Guantanamo Bay. And a suicide bomber blew himself up outside a fast food joint in Tel Aviv.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,376 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports over 38,000 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. In 2004, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Monday, April 17th, 2006. I'm Isaac Kaplan-Wolner.
And I'm Lisa Lewis. In the week since its shares went up for purchase on the New York Stock Exchange, a corporate speculator has already triggered an Oregon state law against utility takeovers. The Securities and Exchange Commission reported last week that Harbinger Capital Partners Master Fund, LTD, snapped up 4.5 million shares of stock in Portland's electric utility. The Oregonian reports today that Harbinger is a hedge fund with a Cayman Islands address. The day after the sales was announced, an attorney for the State Public Utility Commission alerted the speculators that, under Oregon state law, PUC approval is needed before any entity can own 5% or more of the voting securities of a publicly traded utility. Harbinger's cash-in increased speculation that a PGE buyout is in the works because a quick turnaround would earn a big profit for early investors. The disclosure comes less than 2 weeks after PGE issued 62.5 million shares of stock and ceased to be a subsidiary of the bankrupt Enron. The utility began trading on the New York Stock Exchange April 10th.
The state is expected to learn today whether major tobacco companies plan to cut their settlement payments to Oregon by as much as $14 million this year. At stake is money the state is counting on to help fund the Oregon Health Plan for low-income residents. The 1998 settlement is between 46 states, including Oregon, and the four largest tobacco companies. The companies agreed to pay the states $246 billion to compensate for the costs of treating smoking-related illnesses. In return, the states agreed to give up their lawsuits against the industry. The agreement allows the companies to reduce that payment if they lose market share as a result of the settlement. But state officials have pledged to sue to get the money.
The Supreme Court said today it will not hear a challenge to an Oregon law requiring tax-related ballot measures to include a warning that taxes may increase more than 3% if the warning is misleading. It lets stand an appeals court ruling which overturned one by federal judge Anker Haggerty of Portland. Haggerty had found the warning too vague. The case was brought by Michael Caruso of Dundee after voters turned down his ballot measure for money to study formation of a public utility district. Caruso said if the warning allows opponents of similar measures to wage, Caruso said the warning allows opponents of similar measures to wage distorted campaigns. Counties must include the warning because they have the power to raise the assessed value of all property by that amount. Haggerty ruled that the warning was misleading by implying Caruso's ballot measure would increase property taxes 3% by itself.
As Oregonians line up to get their taxes in by tonight's deadline, a new report from the Oregon Center for Public Policy shows Oregon taxpayers are paying more than their share. KBOO's Kirk Vanderveer reports.
Oregonians are paying more than their fair share of taxes on this tax day. A new report from the Oregon Center for Public Policy says that's because corporations are paying less. It shows that in the past 25 years, tax breaks and shelters have significantly reduced the amount corporations pay. Report author Michael Leachman says Oregon needs to put the income back in corporate income taxes.
In the next budget cycle, corporations will pay just 4.5% of income taxes. The rest of income taxes, 95.5%, will be paid by individual taxpayers, including small businesses.
Leachman says Oregon's future depends on investing in things like education, infrastructure, and social services.
Our ability to make those investments is made much more difficult by the fact that corporations aren't paying their fair share of income taxes.
In the mid-70s, corporations paid 18.5% of Oregon's income taxes. Corporate advocates say lower taxes on corporations are good for Oregon's economy, but the study notes that state and local taxes are a very small part of corporations' costs. Content was provided by the Oregon News Service. I'm Kirk Vanderveer, KBOO News.
Portland's own experiment in community, Dignity Village, holds a unique fundraiser this week. Live in the studio with us is Dreddy Dave. Welcome, Dave.
How you doing?
Good. Tell us about your fundraiser.
It's the National Coalition for the Homeless. Dignity Village and Merrimack Pictures are pleased to announce a shoe drive for the homeless people nationwide in conjunction with the release of the premiere film Kinky Boots. The film is inspired by the true story of a traditional Englishman's footwear factory in Northamptonshire, which turned to production of kinky boots for transvestites in order to save the ailing family business and safeguard the jobs of the local community. The Broadway Metro Theater will premiere the movie April 18th at 7 p.m. in Theater 1. Please come a little early to drop off your donations of sturdy, usable shoes with volunteers from Dignity Village. The 18th and the 20th will be having a table out there for your donations.
All right, for our listeners who just moved to town, tell us about Dignity Village. What is it? What do you do? And how can people support your work other than going to this fundraiser for you?
It's a village that's out there for people to get up off the streets where they can feel comfortable with themselves, you know, to help them get in a community of people that are supportive of them, where you can live somewhere without being harassed, you know, and you can actually get up, get you a job, stabilize your life and everything. I came here from a different state, found out about the place, and it's very helpful for me. As you know, we do a lot to help each other. You know, I help build out there. I help do the trash and sanitation with other people out there, and it's really good.
So this is a tent village. What's the difference between Dignity Village? Just real quick, the difference between Dignity Village as opposed to, you know, the services provided by the city and other charitable organizations around town. I mean, what makes Dignity Village so dignified? You know,
we're in charge of ourselves. We don't have people come in and ask them for money to stay there or anything. All we ask is that you donate 10 hours of your work towards helping maintain the village a week, which is nothing really. You know, you spend more time out on the streets trying to find something to do than in one day than you do just helping this place in a week.
All right. And tell us one last time how our listeners can come out and support your event this week, and, you know, a little bit of just how it relates to Dignity Village. What's Kinky Boots going to do?
Well, we're going to set up these booths where you can come out and drop off your shoes and everything, and when we're going to take them back, put them in, and then I guess there's going to be we're going to redistribute the shoes directly at the O'Brien Square at the corner of Washington and Park what is it, downtown between 1 and 3 o'clock Sunday the 23rd. We're going to take all the shoes and then give them back to the homeless people.
All right. Cool. Thanks a lot, Dave.
All right. Thank you.
That was Dave, Dready Dave from Dignity Village.
An overheated electrical cord started a fire that forced the evacuation of more than 200 residents from a Salem retirement home during the Easter holiday. The residents escaped without injury and were allowed to return home. The fire struck yesterday at the Lancaster Village Retirement Home in northeast Salem. The firefighters were able to contain the blaze to a mechanical room. Officials say the fire was started by an electrical cord that overheated due to combustibles being placed on top of it. A damage estimate was not available.
A candidate for city council in Milton Freewater has a court date this week on charges resulting from a tug of war over the Mexican flag. Police said Greg Sterling confronted students in front of the city hall during a demonstration April 6th, and officers had to pull him away from the students and flags to arrest him. Milton Freewater Police Chief Mike Gallagher said two police officers watched Sterling exchange words with about 60 students on a sidewalk in front of City Hall. Sterling pulled two or three of the students into the roadway, and six more followed, Gallagher said. He said officers had to stop traffic. Sterling was charged with assault and disorderly conduct. Both charges are misdemeanors. Police said the assault charge involved a female student who received minor injuries. He's to appear in court Thursday.
The Deschutes National Forest today plans to open several areas to cutting and gathering personal firewood. Maps and permits can be purchased at U.S. Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management offices. The cost is $10 per cord of wood with a two-cord minimum. Most of the wood that can be taken is debris or trees that are lying on the ground. But dead trees can be cut down, as long as they're not being used by nesting birds or other wildlife. Last year, woodcutters gathered nearly 14,000 cords of firewood on public land in central Oregon.
A new study indicates that staying active may be more of a factor in fending off weight gain for adults than cutting calories. A study on monkeys at the Oregon National Primate Research Center found no strong relationship between the level of food intake and weight gain. Researchers said the most active monkeys gained less weight despite being fed the same high-fat diet. The results suggest that eating more food is not the primary cause of weight gain during the adult years. 3 out of every 5 adult Americans are considered overweight or obese.
Claims that Department of Environmental Quality auto emission test stations waste millions of dollars on bad testing have been dismissed by an independent review. The $80,000 review ordered by state lawmakers found only slight differences in results at DEQ stations in the Portland area. State Representative Jeremy Crummell of Wilsonville requested the review after a university researcher complained about differences in test results that could require costly and unnecessary car repairs. But it may be academic. The test in question is being phased out this year.
The current time is 5:15, and still to come on the KBOO Evening News, the Supreme Court won't intervene in the case of two Chinese Muslims locked up by mistake at Guantanamo Bay. A suicide bomber blew himself up outside a fast food joint in Tel Aviv, and the nation of Qatar said today it would give the Palestinian government $50 million. You are listening to Community Rebu. Rebu. Hey, got it. Community Radio, KBOO, in Portland, Vancouver, Corvallis, and Hood River.
The Supreme Court won't intervene in the odd case of two Chinese Muslims locked up by mistake at the Guantanamo Bay prison. The men were accidentally captured as enemy combatants more than 4 years ago, and a judge has since ruled their detention isn't legal. But the federal courts can't help. The administration doesn't want to release them unless they leave the country, but Washington hasn't been able to find a country to accept them. They can't go back to China because they might be tortured or killed. Even though the administration says they have access to rare Guantanamo luxuries like TV and soccer games, the detainees' lawyers says their detention is still a hardship. Arguments before a lower appeals court are next month.
Test scores for about one out of every 14 students aren't being counted toward the No Child Left Behind laws requirement for all races to show progress. An Associated Press analysis finds schools aren't counting nearly 2 million student scores. Minorities are by far the most likely group not to be counted when schools report progress by racial groups. One mother says she can't believe her daughter is tested just like other students, but isn't being counted. Her daughter is among 24 black students whose test scores weren't broken out by race at her suburban Kansas City, Missouri high school. State education officials are using a loophole that allows schools to exclude scores from racial groups that they deem too small to be statistically significant.
Today, the KBOO News focuses on New Orleans. First up, KBOO reporter Martha Odom has traveled to the Lower Ninth Ward, where she's embedded with a nonprofit relief group, Common Ground. We caught up with Martha by cell phone, and this is her report.
The destruction is beyond anything I imagined. It is now 7.5 months post-Katrina, and the recovery is so minuscule that it makes my heart ache. I can't really find words to wrap around it to describe it, but if you pictured starting at Burnside and the east side of the river, and you walked to 39th Street, and you marked every single house you came to with a big TFW for toxic flood water, and then you kept doing that till you got to Division, you would pretty much have a picture of a big part of the Upper Ninth Ward. About one house on each block is occupied. Somewhere on a block, you'll get a pile of debris about the size of a cord of firewood. Streetlights are still out. There's broken water mains. Very few markets are open, say in this Burnside to Division to 39th. You would plop three stores. One of them would be gas pump. And then you cross the waterway into the Lower Ninth, and it's 10 times worse. It is unspeakable devastation. The neglect that made the levees break in the first place was criminal, that it's come 9 months this far, or 7 months this far afterwards, and there's so little repair, so little debris hauled away. It's unbelievable. Common Ground has teams of volunteers go out to gut houses, and the intent is to do a grid so that there's actually somebody on every block. There's private contractors working. A lot of them are hiring undocumented workers, not paying them well, and not giving them protective gear, the mold problem. All of this had 5 feet of flood water for maybe 10 days. So the mold problem is deadly. Common Ground volunteers suit up in Tyvek suits, have the right respirators, wear rubber overboots and latex gloves inside of rubber gloves when they go to get a house, and folks still get, every cut gets infected, everybody's sort of got respiratory distress. The original devastation is beyond anything I imagined. The lack of repair, cleanup. Trees are still down, power lines are still dangling. businesses are closed, so there's not jobs. But every once in a while you see a sign. It says, I am coming home, I will rebuild, I am New Orleans.
That was KBOO's Martha Odom reporting from New Orleans.
And now we continue our New Orleans focus with commentary by Pennsylvania death row inmate Mumia Abu-Jamal.
I call this the Forgotten Ones, Katrina. Amidst the blizzard of congressional, bureaucratic, and administrative reports on Hurricane Katrina, the only thing left out is what was left out from the very first day, and every single day thereafter, the people. It has been 6 months after the nation's worst natural and political disaster. And still, things are as unstable, as unsure, as chaotic for the tens of thousands of people who were too poor to leave during the night of the catastrophe. While politicians fight over airtime, and report after report is issued, the mostly black residents of the city, especially those who dwelled in the lower Ninth Ward, are spread across the country fighting FEMA for housing funds, seeking jobs, trying to put their lives together. Meanwhile, corporate and city planning agencies are writing off vast areas of the Ninth and planning for a new New Orleans, one that will be, shall we say, a good deal less chocolate. Many former residents are crunched into tiny hotel rooms. Some are squeezed into private homes. Some are even homeless, while 100,000 trailers acquired by FEMA stand idle, empty, unused. It is a telling measure of social and class difference that when so many people are living in such distress, the white corporate media goes into a silly cycle because the city's mayor told a group of Katrina survivors that New Orleans would be a chocolate city again. A recent study on the future of New Orleans suggests that the new New Orleans will be whiter and wealthier than the city which was struck by the winds and waters of Katrina. The study, headed by John R. Logan, entitled The Impact of Katrina, Race and Class in Storm-Damaged Neighborhoods, shows how 80% of black New Orleanians may never return. Indeed, nearly 50% of white working-class residents may not return either. Logan, a sociology professor at Brown University, reports that local and state political and business leaders are looking to make sure that New Orleans has a new constituency, one whiter and wealthier than those who came before. Remember the high and lofty promises that were spit into microphones when Katrina was still news? Words, blather, promises. There's another reason why monies promised have never really reached the Crescent City. War. The Iraq War is like a fiscal vacuum cleaner, sucking up every buck not nailed down. The images of Katrina have not faded. They echo around the earth, bouncing off satellites, teaching, telling, revealing. In the very beginning, the images told us that this nation, the richest since Rome, didn't really give a damn about black poor people. It has been half a year, and that message resonates today just as clearly as it did yesterday. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
The Bush administration has ordered America's national parks to show that they can function at 80% or less of their current operating budgets. This is forcing some parks to cut services for visitors as summer approaches. Park officials in the field said the initiative was forcing, quote, gut-wrenching decisions that visitors will notice. At many parks, volunteers will take on larger roles, and there will be fewer interpretive ranger programs, the officials said. President Bush is proposing to cut an additional $100 million from the park's $2.1 billion budget next year. According to a report this month by the Government Accountability Office, the parks have an estimated $5 billion maintenance backlog. And even before the cost-cutting began, many of them had moved from slashing back-office operations to trimming visitor services.
In the Supreme Court today, justices heard a case that could affect what constitutes retaliation of an employee by an employer in the workplace. FSRN's Leigh Ann Caldwell reports on the case where a woman in a non-traditional position claims she was retaliated against after she reported sexual discrimination and harassment.
The respondent, Sheila White, was employed by Burlington Northern and Santa Fe Rail Company in 1997 as a forklift operator. She was the only woman to ever hold that position and was hired because of her prior experience. After 90 days on the job, she complained to her boss of sexual discrimination and harassment by her supervisor and her co-workers. The supervisor was suspended and told to take management classes. But 10 days later, White was transferred to the position of rail remover, which is much more tedious and a job she had no experience in. Her pay and benefits remained the same, though. White filed a discrimination claim to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission for sex discrimination and retaliation. She then filed a second charge 2 months later after she was placed under constant supervision. The following day, White was suspended for insubordination and placed on suspension and without pay for 37 days. Sheila White explains that time.
Rough, tough, mentally, physically, mental just disturbed. No income, no sense of life, loss of enjoyment of life. So it was just rough for me and my kids because I had two in college away from home. So it was rough because I was a single parent taking care of all three of my children.
White's attorney warned the Supreme Court that if these actions are ruled non-retaliatory, then it will deter people from making harassment claims under Title VII. Attorney Carter Phillips.
An individual who complains about discrimination, whether it's race, sex, national origin, has to be free to do that, free from the fear of being retaliated against, whether the retaliation is severe, like a suspension, loss of a job. The petitioner's argument is that you can do anything that you want to an individual within a job classification. We say that is a bad rule because women won't complain if they know they're going to be sent to the worst jobs possible.
The petitioner, Burlington Northern, said that the shifting of positions was not a tangible act. No direct economic effect was incurred. Therefore, it doesn't constitute retaliation. The petitioners warned the court that if this lateral move is considered retaliation, then employers will not have as much latitude and freedom with employees' positions and responsibilities. Attorney Donald Donati.
If you're an employee in the workforce today, under the way the plaintiff is analyzing this case, the smartest thing you can do is the day you show up at work is complain about discrimination in the workplace, and in that way you will guarantee that you are more broadly protected against any retaliation, whatever that means, than you would have been against any ordinary discrimination in the first instance. And as I said in court, it's clear to me that Congress did not intend that.
The court will carefully examine Title VII. Section 703 deals with discrimination, in which it is clearly defined. Section 704 deals with retaliation and is more vague. The court could decide how broadly Congress wanted to interpret the retaliation portion. Conservative Justice Scalia was the most engaged in the debate and seeming to be undecided. Questioning the petitioner intensely, he asked Burlington Northern if there was a nice job and a rotten job within the same company. Under their interpretation of tangible act, the employer will have an end run around Title VII. Charles Carver is a professor of labor law at George Washington University.
The courts have been struggling to decide how negative the action has to be before it constitutes impermissible retaliation where someone's opposed practices that are illegal under the statute. And what I've always found difficult is they often allow more negative treatment in this area without finding a violation than they would if it were just in the general provision prohibiting discrimination based on race, color, sex, religion, or national origin. If I transfer someone to a less pleasant position because of their race or their gender, the courts almost always say that's illegal discrimination. But if I transfer you to a less pleasant position that isn't too onerous, because you've opposed practices you think are illegal, the courts often say, well, that's all right. That's not sufficiently negative to be illegal.
Justice Ginsburg, the only woman on the court, seemed to side with the respondent. The decision will be released later this year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The New York City Police Department has launched a new video surveillance program. FSRN's Mitch Jezerich has the story.
The NYPD began the new surveillance program by placing three wireless video cameras along Knickerbocker Avenue in Brooklyn. The cameras were the first installment of a high-tech surveillance program to place 500 cameras throughout the city at a cost of $9 million. Hundreds of additional cameras could follow if the city receives federal grants as requested to surveil Lower Manhattan and parts of Midtown. The program is modeled after security measures in London's financial district. Law enforcement and transportation agencies have already about 1,000 cameras in the subways, with 2,100 scheduled to be in place by year 2008. An additional 3,100 cameras are monitoring city housing projects. Civil libertarians are calling the NYPD's camera purchases a binge with Big Brother run amok. The NYCLU argues that cameras can't stop crime in the first place. It cites a 2002 study that concluded that closed-circuit systems used in 14 British cities had little or no impact on crime, just as it didn't stop last year's bombing of the London subway system. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich in New York.
The FAA is now allowing the state of Idaho to issue permits to ranchers for aerial shooting of predators to protect livestock. A new category of light sport aircraft has spawned a squadron of unconventional flying craft known as aerial ATVs. Previously, the FAA determined that because ultralight craft could only be flown for sport and recreation, using them for livestock protection was prohibited. Now, at the request of the state of Idaho, light aircraft has been recategorized. Under the new rule, powered parachutes and other ultralights that meet certain weight, speed, and capacity standards can be certified and receive a tail number, just like a full-size private airplane. The test required for a light sport aircraft pilot certificate is not as extensive as a traditional pilot's license. Wildlife activists say the use of kit-built and experimental flying contraptions for airborne attacks on wild animals is dangerous and absurd. State law authorizes the Idaho Department of Agriculture to issue permits for people to, quote, shoot, capture, harass, or kill wildlife that is threatening livestock while the person is airborne in an aircraft.
If the 1906 earthquake that rocked San Francisco struck today, how bad would it be? A new study indicates between 1,800 and 3,400 people would die, and there would be $150 billion in damage. It says a repeat of the 7.9 trembler would damage more than 90,000 buildings and displace up to 250,000 households. The study, called When the Big One Strikes Again, was conducted by the Charles Kirscher & Associates engineering firm. Today's release comes a day before the 100th anniversary of the San Francisco quake. The study was commissioned by organizers of the 100th anniversary earthquake conference, which begins tomorrow. The conference is one of many events being held around the Bay Area to commemorate the 1906 quake and promote earthquake preparedness.
The current time is 5:33. And now, daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
At last, Tom DeLay has succumbed to the scandal of his own making and finally done something positive for the people. Resigned from Congress. Tom's had a bad spell the last couple of years. He's been cited by his own congressional colleagues 3 times for ethics violations. He and his 2 top aides have been indicted for money laundering in Texas. He was forced to give up his post as majority leader. He is hopelessly entangled in the criminal deeds of super sleaze lobbyist Jack Abramoff. And the polls showed that even the people in his own congressional district, a district he drew for himself, by the way, were rejecting him for re-election. The only thing worse that could happen to Tom would be for Dick Cheney to invite him to go hunting. DeLay is a man of many nicknames. When in the state legislature in the 1980s, he was called Hot Tub Tommy, for he was quite the party boy. Then he got to Congress and got serious, becoming known as the Hammer for his mafia-like style of demanding that corporate lobbyists put millions of dollars in Republican campaign coffers in exchange for legislative favors. But DeLay might ultimately be remembered for his latest nickname, Representative Number 2. That's how he's listed in the legal papers of the multi-agency task force investigating Jack Abramoff's corrupt dealings with congressional leaders. Tom says that God told him to step down from Congress. But I suspect that God's way of delivering that message was in the form of DeLay's mounting legal woes. This is Jim Hightower saying, meanwhile, the corruption that Tom cultivated between lobbyists and lawmakers continues unabated in the Congress. Top leaders want us to believe that DeLay's departure clears the air in Congress, so there's now no need for serious ethical reforms. But that's like hanging an air freshener on the tail of a hog. Tom's gone, but the source of the stench remains. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
Stay tuned for independent native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m., hear Labor Radio. Tonight's topic is the Great Tax Shift, how corporations are paying less and less in state taxes, leaving workers to pick up the slack. At 7, it's Time Sound with Kevin Barry. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy with lows 35 to 40 degrees. Hood River will be partly cloudy with a slight chance of rain showers in the evening and a low of 34. Corvallis will be partly cloudy with a low of 38 degrees. Tomorrow, partly sunny with highs 60 to 65 degrees. Hood River will be partly cloudy with a high of 67, and Corvallis will be partly cloudy with a high of 60 degrees. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
Qatar said today it would give the Palestinian government $50 million in an aid to help make up for shortfall after the United States and the European Union cut off funding. The official Qatar news agency said the funds were offered to bolster the budget of the Palestinian Authority based on the decision of the Arab summit held in Khartoum, Sudan, in March. On Sunday, Iran said it was sending the same amount of money to the Palestinians to help fund the Hamas-led government. The United States and the European Union have cut off hundreds of millions of dollars in aid to the Palestinian Authority following Hamas's victory in legislative elections in January. They are demanding the group renounce violence and recognize Israel.
Thousands of Palestinians filled the streets of Gaza City today to commemorate Prisoners' Day. FSRN's Laila El-Haddad reports.
Led by representatives of different factions and accompanied by high-ranking government officials, the demonstrators raised flags and shouted slogans in support of the thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. They marched through the streets of Gaza and Ramallah to the Palestinian Legislative Council, carrying pictures of their imprisoned family members and in some cases symbolically tying their hands together with chains. They called on their MPs, human rights organizations, and the world community to make the release of the prisoners a top priority. Over 8,000 Palestinians are being held in Israeli prisons or detention centers by the Israeli army, including 370 minors and 103 women. The vast majority are regarded as political prisoners, and most are held without trial, according to the Israeli human rights group Beit Salem. Palestinians have been subjected to the highest rate of incarceration in the world, with over 20% of the total population arbitrarily detained or imprisoned by Israel since its occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip in 1967. This, according to the Palestinian prisoners' rights and support group Al-Damir. Their conditions of detention are extremely poor and in some cases life-threatening. For Free Speech Radio News in Gaza, this is Leila Al-Haddad.
Israel celebrated the opening of the 17th parliament under the shadow of a suicide bombing in Tel Aviv, which killed 9 people and wounded 60 more. FSRN's Iris Mockler reports from Jerusalem that during the ceremony, Israel's president called on the new Palestinian government to recognize Israel and to realize the dreams of people on both sides for peace.
The bombing occurred lunchtime Monday, near a fast food stand in a bus station in Tel Aviv. It was the second attack at the same stand in less than 3 months. A fence had been put up following the previous attack. The bomber stood outside it and detonated a large suicide belt. The food stand and the next door jewellery stall were both destroyed. Moti Ahamara was visiting a friend at his record shop across from the food stand and witnessed the bombing. I saw bodies and burnt cars. I knew straight away what was happening because when I turned, I saw the body of the bomber in pieces. And near him, people without hands and legs, says Moti Ahamara. I was slightly injured too, but the sights I saw are the most traumatic thing. Israel's police chief Moshe Karadi says he doesn't know why the same place was targeted twice. He says police will investigate whether there's a problem with security there. The Islamic Jihad group has claimed responsibility, and the bomber's believed to be a 16-year-old from the West Bank town of Jenin, Samer Salim Hamad. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has condemned the bombing, describing it as an act of terror. The shadow of this attack fell over the opening of Israel's 17th parliament, which took place less than 2 hours later. Sad religious songs marked the opening ceremony. This parliament has more doctors, professors, and generals than the last one, but fewer women. The proceedings began with an address by Israel's president, Moshe Katsav. He called on the new members of parliament to work for greater equality between rich and poor, and also between Israel's Jewish and Arab citizens. He then turned to the Palestinians, asking their new government to renounce violence, said President Katsav.
The Palestinian people have made great strides via the path of negotiations, but threw those achievements away when they opted for terror. By choosing terror, and we saw its continuation today, you have brought a great tragedy on yourselves as well as us.
The veteran Israeli politician Shimon Peres is the parliament's acting speaker until a coalition government is formed. In his address, he also referred to social issues and then to the Palestinians.
We have to put before ourselves the challenge of dealing with our Palestinian neighbors with respect and empathy. We can't allow them to suffer financially because of their leadership. The Palestinians are not our enemy. Terror is.
Acting Prime Minister Ehud Olmert insisted on reserving a seat for his predecessor Ariel Sharon, who's not a member of this parliament. Sharon's been in a coma for more than 3 months, and prayers were said for him. Speaking before the opening of the parliament, Olmert said Israel would take action in response to the Tel Aviv suicide bombing. Iris Makler, Free Speech Radio News, Jerusalem.
Afghan President Hamid Karzai urged U.S.-led coalition forces on Monday to show restraint when attacking militants in residential areas, after more than a dozen civilians and police died in two possible friendly fire incidents. As commanders began investigating the 13 deaths, U.S. and Afghan troops kept up pressure on insurgents in volatile Kunar province bordering Pakistan. Pakistani soldiers also deployed on their side of the frontier to stop Taliban-led fighters fleeing across the mountains. Local villagers complained that 7 residents were killed Saturday when U.S. troops, backed by warplanes and artillery fire, targeted militants in a house and nearby cave in Kunar. The military said it did not know if the 7 were killed by artillery or airstrikes or if they were caught in crossfire between U.S. soldiers and militants. U.S. authorities offered an apology to the families of the dead.
Some Iraqis say they are optimistic that the government has scaled back a curfew in Baghdad, which started at 8 p.m., but now begins at 11 p.m. SSRN's David Enders reports.
For nearly the past 2 months, Baghdad has been a ghost town after dark, with the only people officially allowed on the streets being the U.S. military and Iraqi military and police. The 8 p.m. curfew, enforced intermittently since December's national elections, became a fact of life after the bombing of the Askariya Shrine in Samarra on February 22nd. On Adasat Street, a once bustling business district with upscale stores and restaurants, one business owner says the curfew has reduced traffic in his shop to the point he could no longer pay rent. Others say that the first day of the curfew brought some tentative evening customers. Abbas Issa is the manager of Babish Restaurant and says that he hopes business will continue to pick up so that he can rehire some of the staff he has laid off.
About 4 families came yesterday after 8 o'clock and left after 9 o'clock.
But such optimism is tainted by the fact that the deadlock over forming a government has yet to be resolved by Iraq's political parties. In other neighborhoods, the effects of the curfew being pushed back have yet to be felt. Hamza Amr lives in Adamiya, a district of the capital that sees almost nightly clashes between guerrillas and the Iraqi police and army.
So far, no one is staying out. There is no security. There is resistance and terrorists. At 8 o'clock, everyone was in their houses.
There's little to suggest that Baghdad has become any less dangerous, and people remain skeptical that things will begin moving in a truly positive direction before a government has been formed. 5 months after December's national elections, Iraq's governmental institutions are beginning to drift in a sort of limbo while waiting for the next administration to take over. The top Shiite political parties, however, remain deadlocked over who to nominate for the position of prime minister, an issue which must be resolved before other positions can be filled. Issa again.
The Iraqi government does not feel the suffering of the people. We are suffering here, and people are being killed in the streets. and they're not establishing the government, and they're not doing their job, which is to alleviate our suffering.
Parliament Speaker Adnan Pachachi, who had called on Parliament to meet today in hopes of forcing a decision, agreed to postpone the meeting in hopes the Shiite parties could come to a conclusion on their own in the next few days. However, after a meeting today, the Shiites renewed their support for current Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari, who has refused to relinquish his nomination to retain the post unless he is asked to step down by Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, the country's ranking Shiite cleric. In Baghdad, I'm David Enders reporting for FSRN.
We now turn to Italy, where Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi reportedly refuses to concede defeat after elections held 2 weeks ago. The Associated Press reports today that Berlusconi will soon be obliged to concede defeat by the narrowest of margins to center-left leader Romano Prodi. Live with us in Studio 2 is KBU reporter Mariano Masolo. Mariano, welcome.
Happy to be here.
For people who know little about Italian politics, can you give us an update about what's going on in the Italian elections?
Well, after a really nasty campaign, we got the election 10 days ago, almost the 9th and the 10th of April. And after a few days of really darkness, it seems to be clear now that the center-left won the election, so Romano Prodi, although with really a scanty margin. So in both houses, so we have the Senate and we have the House. In the House, the margin is really pretty solid, so we have more than 50 seats. The center-left has more than 50 seats just because of kind of winner bonus for the new electoral system. On the House, the margin is really, really narrow, just 2 seats. That means it's going to be pretty difficult to be in power for the prime minister.
So can you tell us more about what's going on behind the scenes in Italy? What's really at stake here over these two men?
Yeah, these two persons are really a different person with different character, and they don't like each other at all. The problem is now we are going to have really a divided Italy. Italy is really split, because really 50% of the people vote for the center-right, 50% for the almost for the center-left. And remember, in Italy, 83% of the people went to the election, so it's really a huge, I mean, almost everybody so went. So the country is really divided now.
And what kind of pressure do you think is brought into this situation by outside forces? Is the U.S. playing any kind of a role in these elections?
Well, honestly, I don't think any country or anybody played a role on this election beyond the Italian people, because the Italians just don't care probably about what the other people think about Italy. I make an example. In the last year, the press, the international press, was really against the Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, and really against because the issue was Silvio Berlusconi controls a lot of the media, so the television, newspaper, everything, and so the issue was really the freedom of expression, freedom of speech in some way for some journalists. But so although a lot of international press was against this, the people, they don't care. So a lot of million of Italians was really happy about it. And so I don't think nobody played a role beyond the Italian.
So how is it then that, in your understanding anyhow, that this election came down to such a tiny margin?
Say again, sorry?
How is it, in your understanding, how is it that this election was so close?
The country is really divided. It seems that the middle class find in Berlusconi, so the person of the center right, somebody who can take care of their own interest. It doesn't seem to be the reality, because a lot of problems arose in the last 5 years, and it seems that the richest region in the north of Italy are really want to stay with the center right. And the region of the, in the center of Italy, not so rich like the region in the north of Italy, they just want to stay with the center left. So really the country is divided. It's going to be a big issue in the next years, how it's going to be.
You mentioned that this was a nasty campaign. Can you talk more about some of the dirty tactics that these politicians used? Were there any kind of evidence of fraud in voting or anything like that?
And it was nasty before the election. During the election, no. I mean, difficult to say, but it's difficult to make any fraud because all the election is there is just a central central system. So all the rules are the same all around the country. The Minister of Internal Affairs check everything. So it's really difficult. I mean, it's really easy to vote.
Okay, and we're just about out of time, but is there a place, Mariano, where our listeners can find out more about Italian politics? Is there a particular newspaper or website you would recommend?
Well, every newspaper has its own website. Difficult to find translated newspaper. Probably the most important is Il Corriere della Sera, and they have also a kind of English version. Or you can find also on the international press, like, let's say, The Economist did a couple of really interesting issues about this election. So The Economist probably is the best one.
All right. Thank you very much. Mariano Mazzolo, thanks for being with us. That was KBOO's Mariano Mazzolo.
And that's the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 17th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You're listening to Reboo, KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264 AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220 HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Kirk Vanderveer. Our assistant producer and tonight's audio editor is Noah Eaton. Special thanks to reporters Martha Odom and Kirk Vanderveer. Our engineer is John Delderfield, and the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. And I'm Lisa Lewis.
And I'm Isaac Kaplan-Wolner. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News, followed by Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30 on the Abe and Joe Show, they host a debate with the candidates for chair of the Multnomah County Commission, Diane Lynn, Ted Wheeler, and Terrence Smith. At 9 on Between the Covers, host Emily Young interviews Elizabeth Gilbert, author of the memoir Eat, Pray, Love, One Woman's Search for Everything Across Italy, India, and Indonesia. At 9:30, the guest is economist Jared Bernstein, author of All Together Now, Common Sense for a Fair Economy. We'll also check in with the Oxygen Collective. They're challenging the Bush administration's plan to clear-cut forests in Oregon's largest unprotected roadless areas. At 10, the guests are Cindy and Craig Corey, parents of Rachel Corey, the 23-year-old peace activist who was killed in 2003 when she was crushed by a bulldozer on the Gaza Strip. The Coreys will discuss the first annual Peaceworks Conference, which will be held this weekend in Olympia. At 10:30 on Stage and Studio, Willamette Radio Theater presents 4 Hours from Omaha by Craig Kenworthy, an original radio play dealing with an elder woman's attempt to balance her life. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Thanks for joining us. Stay positive, Portland.
This is Independent Native News for Monday, the 17th of April. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
a study into education and living conditions among the predominantly Inuit inhabitants of Canada's newest territory has been released. As Craig McCulloch reports, the results show serious problems for the area.
The report details extensive unemployment, poor graduation rates, and an underrepresentation of Inuit in the Nunavut government. The discoveries are found in a final report on the land claims agreement that helped to form the territory 7 years ago. The author, Thomas Berger, a former BC Supreme Court justice, writes that Nunavut is in a moment of crisis. 75% of high school students drop out and fail to graduate. He also says that 45% of the territorial government workers are Inuit, while it was promised during the formation of the area that 85% of the employees would be Inuit. This would be in proportion to the population of the territory. Unemployment is averaging 30%, and in some areas hits a high of 70%. The retired judge found that one of the reasons for the high unemployment and low number of Inuit bureaucrats is the lack of skilled and properly educated Inuit. Berger also recommends that how students are educated be changed. Currently, students are taught entirely in Inuktitut until grades 4 or 5. The curriculum is then switched to English. Berger finds this to be dysfunctional and that some adults cannot function properly in either English or Inuktitut. Berger also finds that suicide, smoking, the spread of sexually transmitted diseases, and tuberculosis far exceeds the Canadian average, a trend also common with many other First Nation communities across Canada. For Independent Native News, I'm Craig McCulloch in Vancouver.
In an effort to curb achievement gaps between Native and non-Native students in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, the district is adding more culture-based classes. As South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Johanna Saylor reports, also on the horizon is a course that will teach the Lakota language.
More Native Americans are attending the Sioux Falls public school system. Program Director Bill Smith says this year about 900 Native Americans are enrolled. However, 2005 test scores show statewide Native Americans are succeeding at lower rates than white students. Smith says Sioux Falls schools are trying to reverse the trend by incorporating Native culture in classes.
A lot of programming that's gone on across our country, the most successful programs in our public schools have been where they've been able to successfully integrate culture into the academics at the school. And so we've got a plan to begin to do that. We're just getting started.
Smith says a Lakota language course is still a couple of years away, but the district is expanding its budget to increase culture-based classes and provide more academic assistance to Native students in middle and high school. I'm Johanna Saylor in Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
One of California's fastest-growing labor pools appears to be tribal casino workers, according to a survey by the San Diego Union-Tribune newspaper. Ellen Churchak has details.
San Diego County has more tribal casinos than any other county in the nation. The newspaper surveyed workers at the five casinos that employed 90% of the county's 12,800 casino workers. The survey found the jobs performed by the workers ranged from serving meals and mixing drinks to dealing cards, greeting customers, counting change, and in some cases handling more money than most people see in a lifetime. Most casino workers were older than 30, many were older than 50. Many were retirees looking for something to do with their time. An overwhelming majority had at least a high school diploma, and many were pursuing higher education with tuition assistance from their employers. A majority of workers earned more than $32,000 a year, the median wage in San Diego County. Some earned as much as $100,000 annually. Casino workers seemed happy with their jobs, with the main drawback cited as having to deal with cigarette smoke and having to work weekends, nights, and holidays. I'm Ellen Churchak in Sacramento.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Ridolfi Incorporated, using engineering and science to improve the quality of the environment for over 15 years. RIDOLFI.com, and by Amerind Risk Management Corporation, a Native venture protecting Indian Country's assets. www.amerind-corp.org. Our theme music is provided by Jeff Silverman. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
This coming Tuesday, April 18th at 7:30 a.m., all three candidates for Multnomah County Chair will square off on the issues with Joe Uris, Abe Proctor, and you, the call-in audience. A no-holds-barred confrontation this coming Tuesday, April 18th at 7:30 a.m. The Multnomah County Chair Race. Don't miss it.